This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Hello, pod people. I am Ben.
And I'm Mandy.
And today we'll be looking at the Christian Bahena Rivera case with Martina Avalos.
A wonderful defense attorney out in San Francisco. She's very, very good at what she does from what we can tell. And she's got some insight into this crazy case that we're getting ready to go over.
Yeah, not to blow it up too much, but she's guaranteed to blow your mind.
Oh, now you're overhyping me. I don't know. I just learned about this case yesterday. So thanks for the opportunity to learn about this case.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Before we even jump into the case, did you have a chance to kind of review his interview, which was actually more of an interrogation?
Yes. That calling it an interview ever seems absolutely wild. It was definitely an interrogation.
Yeah, absolutely. It was 11 hours.
Yeah.
After he came off a 12-hour shift.
Right. And they didn't give him any like real like breaks to sleep. They said they gave him a few breaks, but it seemed like they were very short.
Yeah, that. And I think at one point he actually fell asleep when Romero was questioning him. Actually, the defense attorneys called her out on that because she lied about that on the stand and then, you know, went back, whatever. Now you had sent us something on, what is it? The Reed technique.
Yeah, so that's an interrogation technique. And one of the things that they do is they, you know, you start off a lot of times, you don't call it an interrogation, right? If you can call it an interview or a conversation, it's a better way of framing it for the person. So they feel more, you know, safer in terms of talking to you. Oh, we've got a guest behind you, Mandy.
Oh, that's Gizzy.
It's very common. And, you know, a lot of times, like, police officers won't even know that they're using it. They're trained on it, but they don't actually know the name of it. But it's very widespread in the U.S.
Yeah, the Romero chick is really the one who was primarily interviewing him, quote unquote, because she was a native Spanish speaker. Like, this kid didn't really, he knew very, very little Spanish, so they obviously had to converse in Spanish with him. Just based on this interrogation, it seems like the defense should have been able to get this whole thing thrown out because the kid wasn't even Mirandized. So I don't understand that, how this whole motion to suppress, a judge dismissed it and he still went to trial.
That is a great question. I have no idea. So there's different ways, and they did one way, which is attacking it through a motion to suppress. But if you're doing it through a motion to suppress, you're saying the way in which he was stopped or taken in was also illegal, right? So you're tying it to the Fourth Amendment. Right. But then, you know, the Miranda issue is a Fifth Amendment issue. And it just seems like, I was looking over their motion, and I don't know what filings look like in Iowa, but there's no law. There's no real argument. I mean, maybe you have to do it all orally. Maybe that was a supplemental that you sent me, but I cannot imagine a universe in which this was, you know, admissible. I'm floored. Like, not to mention the fact that there was language issues, how good of a speaker was Romero, or, you know, it just seems like there's just problem on problem on problem. And then the way that they picked him up from his employer.
Oh God, yeah.
It seems like there was not a lot of communication about what was happening. Like the employer made these statements like, well, you know, we might need the farm lawyer there.
Right.
So, you know, Rivera could have reasonably thought that this was related to something with work. Mm-hmm. So he didn't even realize what was happening. You know, and I think it's just shocking that a judge let this in. Shocking.
He didn't know anything at all. He didn't know that, you know, he had the right to tell them to go F off and no, you cannot search my property, my car, my house, nothing. And in fact, I believe it was his cousin who gave the authorization to search his car, yeah. Which that isn't legal, right? Because don't you have to be the owner of the car to give consent?
She was the owner legally because he couldn't purchase one.
Yeah.
I thought his name was on the title.
No, it was either his aunt or cousin purchased the car for him.
Well, I know that, but was it actually? Oh, so his name wasn't on the title.
I don't think his name was on the title.
On the title, but that shouldn't have actually mattered. A lot of times, let's say I'm staying at my friend's house for free, mm-hmm. and I'm not paying any money, but she knows that I'm occupying the guest bedroom. Mm-hmm. Then I have control over that area, and she can't theoretically, unless she has access to it too. Mm-hmm. Allow the search. So it has a lot to do not just about like financial ownership, but like who has access to it. So like a shared space, if we were sharing that bedroom, then that'd be different. But if it's someone's own personal space,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like they were sharing the car. So that does seem problematic too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from what I understand, it was the main car that he used all the time to do whatever he needed to do.
And but you know what could be weird is that there it does appear to be multiple cars. He had the two different cars, so I don't know if the family was sharing the cars or there's, you know, other people were using them. But it also doesn't seem like the law really like exists in this case. Like it just seems like nobody's following any rules at all. The lawyers didn't. The defense lawyers didn't. I mean, it's like this poor guy. He just didn't get a chance at all.
If you were his defense attorney, what would you have done to start with?
Well, I think they were on the right track in the beginning, right? That they're filing the motion to suppress. Right. But you've also got involuntariness and voluntary like confession issues. So it's not just that your Miranda rights are violated. If you know they don't tell you have the right to remain silent and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That will protect you in some ways. But if you choose to take the stand, it still can be used against you. So you need to attack it from a voluntariness, involuntariness standpoint, saying that, you know, these tactics, the way he was interrogated, it rose to the level that he was not able to, you know, effectively give a voluntary, knowing and voluntary confession. He was being coerced, essentially. Oh, and that it's a higher standard, but you have a lot of elements here. So I don't know if they actually went and tried to do that, but it seems like for the same reason, Mandy, you started off with, he was up for 12 hours. This went on for 11. I have never seen a client interviewed for 11 hours. That's wild.
That's stupid. It's ridiculous. I mean, and honestly, these cops, when they went to that farm, I guarantee they had it in their head. This is the kid who did it, just based off the surveillance footage.
Oh, I'm sure. And one of the things that wasn't clear to me is they saw the car, but did they ever see who was inside the car?
You couldn't. You couldn't even. I mean, that's,
you couldn't even tell the jogger was a woman.
Yeah, you couldn't tell. That could have been anybody, you know. And you see her run. You see that black Malibu go this way, and then 20 minutes later, it's going the opposite way to where she was. So I mean, that's not stalking.
The way they describe it is that he's like circling her repeatedly, but really he just goes to some location and then comes back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. And again, I mean, I guess there were certain things on his car, like chrome, whatever, that pointed to it being his, you know, specific Malibu or whatnot. But again, if you look at those surveillance videos, you can't see who the hell's driving it. Just like you can't see who the actual runner is.
And they never identified the vehicle by license plate or anything else?
Nope. Just by the chrome studded wheels or something. And then I think he had chrome on his mirrors.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
So crazy. I mean, also, how big was this town?
It's that's another thing that I kind of throw in here. 1400-ish people, predominantly white, small town.
And so I think that is one of the major things that I noticed early on that I was really bothered about. Like, why was his citizenship status at all a discussion? I mean, and like, you know, it's got to be, if he's especially, he's there as a non-citizen, he's working at a farm, listening to the defense's opening, I was like, okay. I don't want to come into this like disparaging other defense counsel, but she talked about how he's mucking out the stalls and cleaning up poop. Like, there has to be a better way to explain that this is like a, you know, blue collar worker who's doing his best to provide for his family.
Yeah.
And then she was talking about his citizenship status. And then at the end of it, she's like, well, the defense has to bring you evidence and a story. Wait, what? Like, that, what? Absolutely wrong, right? The defense doesn't have to bring you anything. And so she's talking all about like how they have to prove their case. I mean, this has got to be IAC. This has got to be ineffective assistance of counsel. They seem like they are negligent from start to finish. They didn't seem to do an investigation to see if there was any other cars in the area, any other runners, if anyone else had seen him in the area. Did he have an alibi? I mean, wild.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, going back to an alibi, this kid worked 12 hour days for 12 days, and then he's off two. And then he starts the 12 day work days over again. So, number one.
But exhaustion's not an alibi, right?
Yeah, so, exhaustion's not an alibi. So
there was blood on the trunk of his car. However,
it was a dot of blood.
Yes.
One little drop. And
so
she was stabbed 9 to 12 times.
Yes. Yes. So Mike, I'll wait for her to come back. But I want to ask her, in her history, have you ever seen someone stabbed multiple times and they're not people? Because where was the blood on the ground? Like, where? Well, we don't know where she was killed, but I don't know. Nobody there should have been blood.
They haven't even found it. They don't even have murder.
Well, it also seems like they were talking about certain things about the DNA, but they didn't bring up transference. They did talk about there was other contributors, which deeply concerning, right? They didn't DNA test anyone else, because you can see when there's multiple contributors, certain things, but it's not going to tell you exactly who they are, unless maybe you have a sample and you can run it against a database. But a defense attorney is probably not going to have access to anything like that.
They did bring in experts, you know, to counter what the prosecution was, because they oversimplified everything with their forensics, quote unquote, because from what I understand, there was like, I guess, I want to say three different DNA profiles from that. One was Molly's, one was
Rivera's,
and then
unknown.
They don't know, and of course
they don't know. They didn't
swab Dalton, Jack, the boyfriend, at all for whatever reason. So I mean, they have this missing person, but yet they're still hyper focused on him. But my problem with the blood thing is, if she was stabbed 9 to 12 times, like their Emmy said she was, there's no way in hell that there would not be blood all over that trunk.
Even I would think, even if he was prepared and had like a tarp with him, and it would not be a dot of blood.
No, because you think about this, like, okay, they've got the surveillance footage of her running and then him 20 minutes later going the same direction. They're saying that she was killed the same day that she was abducted or whatever.
Yeah, so he wouldn't have had time to.
There's no time whatsoever. Because this is in a residential area. It's not out in the boondocks. So, you know, I don't understand how we can get from surveillance footage of her running, and then all of a sudden there's this big confrontation. You know, he stops his car, gets out, jogs behind her. They get into a confrontation. She apparently slaps him. And then from there, he panics and kills her. All done with witnesses.
Neatly, with nine stabs.
Neatly, exactly.
And where they did this, right? So if they've got an idea of where they were on the road, right? Why couldn't they have looked to see where there might have been an incident? Then there was that FBI data that seemed incredibly suspect. So there was one officer who was testifying to the FBI locations of where the quote-unquote event was, but it was unclear what it was. Like, it just seemed like it was multiple layers of hearsay, right? So this officer saying, well, the FBI told me there was an event at this location and it was traveling at this speed. And I would have really wanted to have seen the data, what the cell phone tracking information was, because I have never been provided cell phone tracking information that shows you what speed the cell phone was traveling at. Like, I'm just really questioning whether or not that exists at all.
It does, because I mean, there's apps that you can actually put on your phone. Like, if your speedometer or whatever goes out, that will track you, like a GPS satellite would track you and tell you how fast you're going. So that is a thing.
Of your own phone, but that depending, did they get into her phone? Did she already have that? Usually the cell phone data that I'll get from, and I'm sure the FBI's are better, right, than local data, but you get pinging, like triangulation.
Right.
And so you'll be able to see where the car was or where the cell phone was at a certain time. And so they can potentially come up with the speed from that by, you know, cross-referencing the distance and time. So if it's, you know, 7 o'clock, it's here, and 7:05, it's there, it must have been X number of miles. But it just seems pinging's really imprecise. So they're saying that there was an event on her phone, or maybe it means that at that time, the cell phone wasn't moving. She had stopped. So they're pinpointing it to that location. If you have that information of where the event was, where she was stopped, why didn't you go to the scene? Shouldn't there be blood all over?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. And then where her body was, right? She's got no shorts, no underwear. It's in the middle of nowhere. So it looks like it's like a staged, to me, it looks staged like a rape scene, but they have no semen. So it's like, this wouldn't be in a location where this person would have been caught by somebody. They wouldn't have been caught off guard. Why did they not go through with this process? Like, to me, it looks staged.
Yeah. And I mean, there's something about it. There tends to be, I mean, 9 stabbings, I don't know, could go either way. But, you know, a lot of times the number of stabbings, the manner in which somebody attacks somebody else, it could be evidence of how kind of intimate the relationship is, right? Like 50 stabs.
Yes, yes. We didn't even think that.
Yeah, so like the 9 to 12 stabs seems like more than enough, right? That seems like it strikes a boyfriend, somebody, jilted lover. I don't know. Exactly. I just, my first thought, it seems weird for a stranger.
Yes. And when I was first watching the case, instantly I felt anxiety around Dalton Jack. There's something wrong with this guy. But then Rivera leads him to the bottom. I'm like, oh, okay, I was wrong. But there's just seems something off about that guy. And I didn't even think about the 9 stabs. That's a brilliant point, because if Rivera just is jilted by her, he's just jogging beside her and she's like, look, I'm not into you, I'm going to call the police. I guess if you're like a lunatic, you might strike her, but you're not going to stab her 9 times.
Yeah, that's overkill.
I wouldn't even think he would have a knife in that circumstance.
You know, so I would have wanted to talk to friends and family. Maybe they did. I saw that they put some family members on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the ex-girlfriend, which I think was a good move. Yeah. But, you know, this guy who just gets so mad because he gets rejected that he stabs a woman 9 times must have in his past been mad at somebody.
And blacks right? out. Like, forget that.
I mean, I'm sure this is not the first time he was rejected by someone. So. Right. It's just, it seems like such an illogical motive.
Well, not only that, he doesn't speak English. And right. I'm pretty sure she doesn't speak Spanish because, you know, predominantly white town, they ain't learning Spanish, I guarantee it.
Well, and that's an interesting point too, which is how often is he going around hitting on white women, right, in that town? Probably not a whole lot in a small town like that, where there's probably really, really, you know, kind of prejudice. Toxic racism everywhere. Like, you know, I bet he would have really felt uncomfortable stopping his car and hitting on a woman like that.
Especially being an illegal immigrant and knowing that his daughter and his family are kind of financially relying on him.
So do you know how the non-citizen got introduced? Because my question is, did the defense think it was a good idea to bring it up to be like, oh, you know, it paints the picture of who he is, or did the prosecution bring it up? Because I think the prosecution brought it up, and I just can't believe that came into the trial. Like, his citizenship status should not have been it.
You know what?
Well,
it wasn't just
DCI
in the trial.
The DCI guys were investigating along with FBI and the local cops too. So I don't know how they. I would assume they were brought in from the very, very beginning.
But it blew up past the trial. Like, Trump tried to use this case.
Let's not bring him into that. I don't even want to.
Well, he did, though. He tried to utilize this case, and her dad was like, no, we're not going there. This is about my daughter, not. Amen. But yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah, but there's a way of keeping things out of the trial that aren't relevant, even if it's happening in reality. Like if you know, immigration's involved, if they've got their eye on him, it's usually, like in California, we're lucky. Not all of our non-citizens get picked up. and put into removal proceedings. But a lot of times in other counties or other states, that's going to happen. But you still wouldn't have it come into a trial because of the bias, right? Like you wouldn't just, it would just be pieces of information that the judge would say, hey, no one gets to talk about this. It's not relevant to the fact of he killed or he didn't. And someone would have to put a theory forward why they should get it. It's unclear to me who did it. I think it was the prosecution based on the way the defense opened on it. They seemed like they were trying to mitigate, but like that has to have tainted the whole trial. I mean, in California, you still get a lot of, mixed feelings about non-citizens, but Iowa?
That's exactly what I'm thinking, because I grew up in a small town. And I know how they think. And I guarantee you, you're probably right. The prosecution did he didn't get a fair trial, no matter how you shake it. He didn't. Especially, I mean, the jury was 8 women, I think 7 men, and 11 of them were white. That's not a jury of his peers by any means whatsoever.
No, at all. And I mean, this is off the topic, but this is on the topic of my trial. So it was hanging, and we found out the split was 8 not guilty, 3 guilty, 1 undecided, when there was 1 black juror. My client was black and there was a racial issue. As the second the black juror was removed, it flip-flopped within one vote. The next vote, it was 8 guilty. So it just goes to show, not having a jury of your peers like will instantaneously change things. Just having the one person on that jury that represented my client, I think in a lot of ways was keeping people kind of more honest, or maybe less honest about their racism and more on the facts. But then it just all of a sudden flipped. So can you imagine? I mean, in Iowa, not a single, Latino, not a single person who speaks Spanish. And they've, probably a bunch of Trump people who right at this time were totally bought into the narrative of the rapists and the murderers who are coming here from Mexico that we had to build the wall against, that Trump had run. Like, this poor guy.
Yeah, he didn't have a chance.
No.
And I don't know. I think I had a question. I forgot what the hell it was. Should have wrote it down. I hate when I do that. Yeah, I mean, the poor guy didn't have a try. He had no chance whatsoever. But my question is, if you were his defense attorney, would you, given the fact, I mean, you know the area that he's in, and you know that he's not going to have a jury of his peers, would you get him to forego his right to a trial by jury and just go with the judge?
Nope. Never, not ever. I mean, I shouldn't say never, but doing a bench trial is usually the wrong move. I mean, this seems to be fraught with wrong moves, but the bench trial, now you're putting all of your trust in somebody's hands who is very racist, probably. And having somebody who, doesn't necessarily see the ins and the outs of the system, like you don't want to see how the sausage is made, essentially, right? Like, jurors are pure because they don't see all the other people coming in and out. Like, I would guess that most judges, even the ones who are like liberal, forward thinking, are just going to be a bad idea on something like this. If you have a very technical, specific issue where you think you should win because of like jurisdiction or something like that, that, a jury, like it's a sex, say it's like a child molestation case and they just didn't prove up the location or something like that, where a jury is going to be feeling really like, oh, I hate this person. They proved he did it, just not where, or something like that. Maybe you go with the judge, because then they can be blind to their sympathy. But something like this, where you're asking them to say, there's not enough evidence, this is a reasonable doubt case, the DA just didn't prove it. Nope, no way. Because you gotta think that, there's at least maybe one or two people who could see this for what it is, right? Because, the prosecution still needs 12. Better to gamble on the 12 in my mind.
Well, that's true.
There.
That's a fair point.
I really want to ask you about Dalton Jack. In your experience, has anyone that's been interviewed in a trial that is trying to, that should be trying to support their loved one who's been murdered, been so uncooperative?
Did you watch any of his
I don't know in my experience if I've ever seen it. There's a lot of stuff that's weird about him. You know, the first thing that doesn't pass like the smell test for me would be when she was missing, that he didn't even bother to come back.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, he didn't. And
he says he called her 10 times, but the cell phone records show once.
Right.
Yeah, he perjured himself multiple times on the stand.
And so as with the defense attorney, that's something I'm really going to want to look into. Like, where was he? Who couldn't corroborate his hours? Does he have, you know, any witnesses? I would really want to be wanting to get his cell phone records to see where he was.
Well, they had his cell phone pinged at his home. You said the pinging isn't always accurate, but this is like a 2-hour distance. Is that possible?
No. Pinging, what I mean is, so like it's triangulation. So what it'll do is it'll pull the data. Your phone is sending out little messages to all the different, you know, cell phone stations, towers. Mm-hmm. And then it'll triangulate. It'll take the data from all of those to try to get your location at that moment. So it's pulling different data from different towers. So it gives you an approximation of where someone is, but it's not going to be a 2-hour difference. No. We're talking like, you know, yards, not.
Yeah. You know. And he even gave his phone an alibi because his text to her said that his phone was having service issues.
His data plan is not working or something like that. Why would you do that just out of the blue?
Wait, if your data plan wasn't working, I don't understand then how it pinged at home. Don't they? You need the data in order to ping.
Yeah.
I'm confused. I mean, so then number one, I would have wanted a cell phone expert to come in and say, because I can't be an expert in every subject, right? I do my best impossible. To like muddle through, but you know, you have to ask the right questions of the right people. So why did they not have a cell phone expert? Why didn't they go harder on him as the person? I mean, maybe the theory is, you don't necessarily always want to do like what they call the spaghetti defense, where you're like, well, it could have been boyfriend. It could have been these two other guys. It could have been who knows, right? So I either like to keep it very clean and say they didn't prove their case and attack their case, or put forward one clear theory. But if you're going to put forward a clear theory, you run the risk of burden shifting. And they seem to hang their hat on this idea of the other two.
Yeah.
And I mean, that may be based on the fact that he had this statement, right? Which was kind of, I mean, that's going to be a big challenge, right? It is. But when you look at how they are suggesting and leading him into it, I mean, it seems like they could have been just suggesting to him all along. The issue about the location, though, how would he have known the location other than having gone out there with the two other men, is the one thing that I think would have left me the most troubled.
Well, I mean, his story is radical. It is radical. But I mean, I can understand him, you know, because when he was first being interrogated, first few hours, he's like, I didn't do anything wrong. I did nothing. I didn't kill her. Nothing. And then, you know, 11 hours later in the cornfield, he's like, well, I led you here, so I guess I must have done it. You know, but of course, by then, he's completely brain fried and they've got it into his head that, hey, you did kill this chick. You know, and then, but I mean, if there's
and could they have already have found her and just took him there and then?
Well, like, I mean, I really strongly think that Dalton and possibly that Logan guy who turned in the video footage were in cahoots or somebody along those lines. But I definitely think Dalton was involved with it, and you know, just took advantage of the fact that dude got his car on camera, and Dalton, being racist, of course, was like, okay. Because I mean, Rivera's ex-wife went to school with Dalton, flat out said he was racist, which is not hard to believe in a town like that. But I really think it's elaborate, but I think it's smart on Dalton's part to do it that way, you know, because he's a little guy, right? He's like 5'7", 130 pounds. He's not going to be able to fight them off. He's going to do exactly what these two guys say. So Dalton's crime of passion, he's pissed off because, number one, he got caught cheating a couple times. And Molly, of course, was fed up with it. And
they're going to leave him.
They were, yeah. They, you know, I mean, he flat out on a stand said that he was pissed off because she was going to move in with her friends instead of moving in with him. And she messed up all these plans that he had been planning for so long. He actually said that on the stand. So he's thrown motives out there multiple times while he was on the stand. So I think it's very plausible that he and another accomplice did kill her. And probably, like Ben was saying earlier, that she was killed in her house. And they just,
I think it makes the most sense as far as why there's no blood anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you would think something like that, right? So if it really was Dalton, the first thing that would go through my head is, well, it wouldn't have happened outside, right? Because it's like, how does that play out? It plays out like them fighting, like her saying, I'm going to leave, her going to pack, her starting to maybe get ready to go to her friend's house, him trying to stop her. And then that's where, you know, this kind of emotion flares up and then he ends up stabbing her.
Right.
And then the house was completely sanitized. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if the defense ever had anyone go in and look at it, see where her stuff was. Things had been moved, put back in weird places where she might not have normally kept her clothes or stuff like that.
Nobody vetted Dalton except for a few questions. Like, no DNA samples were taken. They didn't search anything, nothing. They just, oh, well, he's a good old boy in the army, so he couldn't have done it.
So I have so many problems with what the defense did from the outset, because one, it seems like they're a private firm. So were they appointed as like stand-in public defenders, or were they a private firm that the family hired? Unclear to me, but either scenario means that they probably didn't have a lot of money to do investigation. Like my office, I have to apply for expert funding. And it, you know, my office is great about it, but a lot of times maybe not so much. But when you're a private attorney and say you take on a low income client who's high profile because you're thinking this is a great idea for me,
right?
The client's gonna have to pay extra for all those extra investigators or experts that you might want. So sometimes going private means you have to end up doing stuff on the cheap. Or if they're appointed, then they have to apply to the court to get funding. So it seems like they were just very lazy from the outset. They were like, we need a DNA guy. Good enough. Like, no, I could see like there's so much more they needed to do from the investigation and from the workup.
Well, I mean, aside from just kind of being sloppy in what they did, I mean, I think they did some, I think they really, and I mean, I obviously I'm not an attorney, so I don't know how to really try a case, but when I was watching them, and I know it's not on them, the burden of proof is not on them, it's on the prosecutors, but in my mind, I think they shed enough reasonable doubt against Dalton, number one, to for the jury to not convict Rivera. I don't understand how any jury can, especially after hearing Dalton a couple times he took stand.
But leading the police to the body is a big gun, though.
It is, but I mean, you've got the other DNA evidence. There was a drop of blood. Chick was stabbed 9 to 12 times. There should be blood splatter somewhere. You know, and I mean, it wasn't, it can't be premeditated. I don't think it was premeditated for any of them.
It doesn't make sense that if he, you know, unless he had the opportunity to clean his car afterwards and he just missed this one drop, maybe that's their theory. Because there was so much time that passed in between and they found it on the liner in the trunk, right?
Because the funniest thing about that is that he says he was going to get a vacuum cleaner from his uncle to clean his car, but he didn't end up cleaning his car because he was too tired. So he intended to clean his car that day and didn't actually clean his car.
Vacuum's not going to get blood up, though.
Yeah, according to them, but also that, vacuum cleaner's not going to get the blood, right? It's just, like, so a sample that small, you would have to, like, bleach everything down, and if this really happened out in the middle of nowhere, and he didn't have gloves, it would be on his clothes, it would be on his hands, he would have, you know, he would have it physically on probably his shoes, right? He's going to have to drag her around, have to drag her, get her inside the car, drive her to location, get her out of the car. He said that she was like a fainted, like it looked like she had fainted, right? Yeah. So it's not easy to carry another human being when they are alive and helping.
Dead weight,
it's crazy.
Especially given the fact that he's a little bit taller, but they're basically the, you know, same weight and everything.
He's smaller. He's slightly smaller than her.
No, she was like 5'2", 5'3". He's 5'7".
Weight wise, I think you said he was 127. She was 132. So, I mean, it's close, but they're,
close
he's a little bit.
But, I, you know, and going back to the fact that they're claiming that she died on the same day that she was abducted, that's not something, it's just not something that can be done that quick. I just really, without their being sloppiness everywhere, because like you said, he'd have blood all over him. So yeah, when he gets in the car to drive away, there's going to be blood in the front seat too.
Right. Did they and ever find the clothes?
Huh?
Did they ever look at his clothes? Because that's another issue too, because someone could have theoretically been able to pinpoint what he was wearing because he left work. Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe the friend didn't remember, but you know, maybe they wouldn't have remembered, but
I don't remember reading or seeing anything where they checked out his clothes. Cause this, I mean, it was a month later.
It was, they could have destroyed it theoretically, but you know, guy doesn't have a ton of money. Would he just wash them or would he throw them away? Right. Like, would his shoes be completely clean? Would he throw them away?
Would he be able to throw them? Well, I mean, I think he was making decent money. Cause I know his ex-wife said he was given $500 to her a month for child support and still sending money back to Mexico for his other family, you know. And that's another thing. From all accounts, he's never had any kind of anger issues. He's always been a fun, jovial kind. Whereas Dalton, on the other hand, even on stand, admitted he had anger issues and admitted that he was pissed off that she was going to leave his ass. I mean, it's so.
He also said he had blackout anger spells.
Yes. Yes. It's like, I just don't get it. I mean, the jury, and I'm sorry, Iowans, I'm sure maybe not you're all like this, but that jury had to be fucking racist and just been like, we're not going to, you know, throw shade on a military dude because, you know how that the blue states, whatever are, or red state. What is it? Red state?
Red state.
Joined, Republic.
Yeah. I think he joined the military after.
After she died. Yeah. Like 3 months, I think. 3 months to the day after she died, because he just couldn't stand to be in the town or whatever.
Yeah, right. And he couldn't stand to be in the courtroom with Rivera. That's why he didn't want to be there. And
yeah, that's
they asked him
question.
Point blank. Yeah, they asked him point blank, you don't want to be here to defend the one you love? And he said, no.
It's like, yeah, I mean, that's the defense weird. Asked him several times, that's you weird. Don't want to be here to fight for her, no.
Yeah, that's very weird. I mean, it's very common to see family at sentencing. Like, that's when they really... in my experience, want to be there, want to read their experience.
But I mean, if this was your true love, like he claimed, and he gave her a, you know, a promise ring, and he was going to propose to her down in Punta Cana at his brother's wedding or whatever, he didn't want to be in the same room as the defendant. He didn't want to fight for her. He didn't want to do anything to help convict him. That doesn't make any sense to me. If it were me, I would be on the stand fucking spilling my guts about everything I could possibly think of, but that's just me.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think that usually cuts against our clients when they don't testify, defendants, right? People are like, well, why wouldn't you get on the stand? So, you know, initially I'm thinking, okay, there's a million reasons why I might not want to testify, right? Like, I would be easily triggered and I would lose my temper and I could make I could hurt the case, right? If you know, it's about me testifying on behalf of my loved one. If the defense attorney started cross-examining me and I lost my temper, then I'd be thinking in the back of my head, I don't want to lose this case for the prosecution because I'm a hothead, and then my loved one not get justice. So, I mean, there's theories I could come up with, but it just doesn't feel right for this guy, right?
But realistically, you're an attorney, so your brain is conditioned to think that way. Someone like me, I would just want blood. I would be out for blood. I wouldn't be thinking about, you know, what if I blow my temper on stand and, you know, fuck up the case for somebody. Because, I mean, the prosecution, if I'm a prosecution's witness, is going to sit down and prepare me for it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it would make more sense if he's, like, getting police on him because he's trying to attack the guy in court, right? Not like, no, I don't want to be here.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. I mean, that could actually go the other way. His temper, he like tries to attack the defendant in the middle of the court and he looks so genuine. I mean, that's true. But I mean, usually as a defense attorney, I can get somebody on the stand to break in a way that they don't see coming. Almost always. You know, I think I'm going to have a very like calm, easy witness. And I always, you know, 9 times out of 10, I get them when they're lay witnesses. So, you know, you could, a good defense attorney can do a lot of damage to an innocent person, you know, who's just there to testify on behalf of their loved one.
So are you saying you feel that the defense should have tried to rile him up and make him visibly angry to the court?
It depends, right? Like, maybe it's not getting him angry, but the defense, I thought it seemed like a very short cross-examination. And it seems like they just kind of did everything very kind of half-assed, right? Like, I would have had him on the stand for a lot longer. I would have gone at it from a lot of different issues. And then, you know, different tactics work with different people. Different lawyers work. Like, I can, you know, a lot of times if it's a domestic violence case, I might be very triggering for a female, you know, ex-girlfriend of my client, right? Whereas, like, you know, one of my colleagues might be really good at doing sweet cross. So you don't always want to do the same thing, but you're going to keep him on the stand for like half a day, a whole day, like play things out, bring up things that you can about their relationship and what you figured out. And it just seems like they didn't really know enough about the relationship. They didn't really specifically question him on a lot of stuff about what had happened up leading up to him going to this construction job. Like, they just sleepy time the whole thing is how it looked to me.
They were basically going off of his Snapchats and his text messages and things like that, and, you know, talking about the relationship between him and Jordan Lamb, and, you know, just throwing shade. I mean, I think they did a good job at throwing shade on him and showing that he wasn't devoted to Molly like you said he was. But they were also, I mean, there were times when they were kind of frustrating me because there would be these huge pauses because they're trying to find shit. It's like they weren't organized, and I can't stand people not being organized. It drives me crazy.
Yeah. And some of that's natural, but you can tell they didn't write it out. You can tell that they didn't really do a lot of investigation about asking about them. They should have had people talking to all of their friends, finding out every single fight that they had had, finding out what had happened. You know, weren't they like high school sweethearts or something?
Mm-hmm. They knew each other in high school. Yeah. So it was kind of like, I think after high school, because they were like 18.
They definitely could have had witnesses saying, have you ever seen Dalton behave inappropriately towards Molly? Right. Like, those things could have occurred for sure.
Right. And maybe you don't need to get witnesses, but you have your investigator go out and get all the people who potentially could be witnesses. And then, you know, like, oh, you guys fought the night of prom. Isn't that true? Like, you hit her. You know, I would be digging and digging and digging to see if there was any physical violence between the two of them.
I don't know that they had an investigator, to be honest.
It doesn't seem like it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of seemed like they just played off of what the prosecution did. No, okay. Yeah, well, they got a DNA witness. We're going to get a DNA expert.
Well, and I know, Mandy, you said you think that they did a good job establishing that he wasn't the greatest boyfriend with these infidelities, but I feel like they could have attacked that a lot harder too. They could have.
The infidelities in some ways don't actually excite me as much as the prior violence and anger between the two of them.
Yeah, those are more important. The infidelities, I would just say, as far as that he didn't care about her that much.
Well, it gives them motive. I wouldn't want to establish that he didn't care about her, because that could cut either way, but it does show that she meant it when she was going to leave. So I like the establishing that she knew, because it would have shown, okay, she was really going to, and she had caught him twice, right? This time she was actually going to go.
Yeah.
But I would want to find out what was her behavior like? What was his behavior like when the first time she found out, did he get mad at her? Like, they had to have had fights about that. People must have seen it.
Nothing was even brought up about any kind of violence or anger issues that they had within their relationship at all.
They lived with the brother too, right?
Yeah, the brother and his wife.
Never interviewed, right?
No, that he was the first person on the stand.
Oh, he was.
The prosecution called.
Okay.
But I mean, it was a stupid.
Yeah, they didn't ask him about their relationship and if they had been fighting prior to her disappearance, which would have been what you need to ask.
Exactly. Right. Like, and talking about. I mean, the brother's not going to be the best person either, right? He's probably going to be very protective of Dalton.
Right.
But that's why you would want to go to her friends, her family, people who would have seen them fighting, people who would have seen them fighting at parties or things like that. Go their cell phone records, friends' cell phone records, who's she texting about, you know, oh, we got in this big fight because I found out that he was cheating on me. That would be like an area that just feels like it would be really fruitful to find evidence of his violent nature. Doesn't seem like they explored it at all. The other thing that was totally wackadoo to me was that they, in the case, the defense waited to open until midway through, and then they had the junior attorney do it.
Yeah.
And I honestly have seen law school students give better openings.
Yeah, I wasn't real impressed with her opening.
And his closing was terrible. I timed it 6.5 minutes before he even said his own client's name. He spent like 3 minutes saying thank you. Like, what?
Oh yeah, thank you to, yeah.
Okay.
Although
for their 2 weeks, my last trial, this last one, which was not a homicide, was 2.5 months. Like, and I definitely didn't even say thank you. Like, good job. You know, you did your job showing up. No, I don't need to say that to you. It was so weird. But in her opening, so they waited to the middle, which is a terrible idea, which usually the only reason you would do that as a defense attorney, because you get the option of doing it at the beginning or waiting until the beginning of your case. But you lose the opportunity to put your side of things out there before the jury hears the evidence. So they hear prosecution's opening, they get prosecution's evidence. By that point, the studies show their minds are made up, they're done, right? They're now cognitive bias is at play and they're not even going to listen to your case. So Mandy, to your point, like why were they, you know, other than being racist? Well, you know, I think the defense set them up to not even be open to hearing their evidence because, you know, primacy and recency is a real thing. So as a defense attorney, you want to hit your opening hard. Talk about how you're going to slam the DNA, that the boyfriend's a problem. Here's your other theory. And she didn't do any of that, right? So by the time they got to her, no one cared.
Well, even with that, though, I mean, when Dalton was on the stand, because he was the prosecution's witness, you know, the defense crossed him. And still, just the way he was acting and the shit that came out under cross, to me, would have been enough to provide reasonable doubt, to throw some shade on Dalton and the fact that there is a chance that he is the one who actually did this. But it didn't happen. I don't understand it at all. Because this kid, I mean, as soon as I heard him talk, it was like in the pit of my stomach, I knew this motherfucker is the one who killed her. I'm sorry, but that's my gut's never wrong.
Yeah.
I can't prove it. But
yeah, there's something I definitely think this whole case feels like it leads back to him. Mm-hmm. DNA of the car, the one thing that feels weird, you know, and I think the fact that, like, you know, they let him out there, who knows whether or not, is that in the section that you sent me, Mandy? Because I didn't see him saying it was at this location. It's like they took him there and then he says, this is here. Like now we're at the location.
Are you talking about during his interrogation?
Yep.
No, I didn't send you the whole 11-hour interrogation. I haven't even watched the whole thing. And all I know is that at the end of the 11 hours, they pretty much had him, they had that coerced confession, basically.
Because based on what I saw when I was watching all the different snippets on YouTube, mm-hmm. and I can't be sure about this, but it seems like there's this gap where all of a sudden they're there at the mm-hmm. location, and it's just he has miraculously led them there, but it's kind of like,
yeah,
how did he say drive down this street, turn right here, turn left there, well, go 100 yards?
I have a feeling they probably, this Romero, you know, because she's being his friend and all and telling him that he just needs to come clean and help himself, and you know, if he can't remember anything, it's because maybe he has a medical condition of blacking out and all this other stuff that she put in his head.
Well, that's speaking of medical conditions, not that he has a condition about blacking out, but I think someone really should have evaluated this poor kid to see what his like competency is. He seems to me to have, you know, like maybe either some developmental issue or some competency issue that makes him more susceptible to these like coerced confessions. And that would have been it. To go back to where we started about voluntary versus involuntary, mm-hmm. you would really have wanted to show that they kind of exploited somebody, not only in the tired state, but also kind of his mental status, because he doesn't seem to be the sharpest, you know, nail out there.
I mean, wouldn't it be prudent to actually see if he was competent to begin with? Because, I mean, just the story of him seeing her just whatever randomly on a street jogging, he drives behind her for a little ways, stops the car, gets out and jogs behind her, and then they have this big confrontation that nobody ever saw.
Yeah,
I mean, that doesn't, that in my mind, because that's not something a normal person I think would do unless you have issues.
Well, I mean, no, it sounds like, to put it another way, let's say he was a super handsome guy, right? And he sees a girl he likes and he gets out and she's jogging along. He jogs behind her a little bit. It's only creepy depending on who the person is, right? If somebody stops you and like he's handsome and you're like, oh, thanks, hi.
That's true. That's true.
But, you know, there's just no evidence that he'd ever engaged in this sort of predatory type behavior,
right?
Where he ran after another woman, right? That just seems, especially for somebody with his demeanor, he seems very kind of meek, kind of, you know, not the type to put himself out there, deferential. Well, does not seem like the kind of guy that would go running after a woman. So I wouldn't even necessarily need to look into that story, right? Okay. Yeah, but I just think he has a low IQ, lower IQ at least.
Yeah, because when you're going back and reading the transcripts of his interrogation, he really, the most he's saying is,
yeah,
and things like that. I mean, he's not proffering any type of conversation whatsoever.
Yeah,
well, and that's where you would have really wanted a false confession expert, right? Because they could say when someone's really tired, like how many times have you had, like, you've been in the middle of a fight with, like, you know, your significant other and you're so tired and they're just yelling at you and you're like, fine. Like, you're just so tired. You're like, please go to sleep. And that seems like what he was doing, right? Like, he's like barely like comprehending what they're saying. There's who knows how good her Spanish was, who knows how things were being, you know, conveyed to him.
He's supposedly a native Spanish speaker.
Sure. You know, that doesn't mean anything. There's also different, you know, like different types of Spanish, like a Cuban Spanish interpreter is very different than Mexican. I just had that issue in one of my trials and the interpreters kept being like, I cannot understand your client. And I'm like, I'm sorry, we don't have a Cuban interpreter.
Oh, wow.
So there's just a big difference, right? Yeah. And if you are a native Spanish speaker in Iowa, what does that mean? Did you grow up in Iowa and you had a grandmother who you spoke Spanish with every other weekend? Like, I don't know.
She's actually from Mexico. Apparently that's why a lot of, she was a police officer in Iowa, and apparently she's used quite a bit for any type of Spanish interpretation because she's from Mexico.
She's probably certified then, but that's not to say native certified speakers can't also have problems, right?
Well, sure, yeah.
And, you know, it's just, there's so many problems with the confession being coerced to state, you know, the lack of food, the lack of water, you know, kind of how they kept him up for a 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
Such a mess.
That right there is enough for me to say, no, this is bullshit. We're not going to, you better come up with something.
What are his options at this point?
So they did the new trial motion. So when you lose, you will do a new trial motion, but it's done by the same lawyers that tried the case.
Right.
So often you have to bring out, you know, information at the trial that you didn't, like information outside that didn't get brought into the trial.
Yeah.
So, you know, jury misconduct, things about that, that's usually one of the big areas of new trial motions. But it's fundamentally done by the same people, usually the same exact trial attorneys. So, you know, you're not always going to be seeing the issues all that clearly in your trial motion. Like if the lawyer missed an issue at trial, it's unlikely they're going to be able to see it by the time the new trial motion rolls around, because it's not like it's not an appeal. So after that was denied and he got sentenced, now he can have an appeal. So that's where the appellate lawyer will look at it. Other people will look at it and hopefully they will say that everything was wrong. So they'll challenge judicial decisions. They'll challenge, you know, prosecutorial misconduct. They'll challenge the defense attorney too. And that's really where you'll see the appellate lawyer going after the defense lawyer to say they didn't do anything they were supposed to. This fell below the standard of care that we would expect. And then they'll cite to all those things that we've been discussing.
How do you get an appellate lawyer? Because this kid doesn't know anything about that stuff.
I don't know in Iowa, but in California, you get one, regardless of whether you're able to pay.
Oh, okay.
How good they are, I don't know. It's a mixed bag, right? Iowa, I'm not sure, but you would think that they would get someone on appeal appointed.
I don't recall seeing anything about that. I mean, I know his new trial was dismissed by the judge. It was rejected.
Yeah. Well, this is all happening pretty recently. Appeals often take years. Yeah. So, you know, they're going to have to order all of the transcripts. They're going to have to go through it, they're going to have to look at it, all, everything kind of start to finish, all the stuff that we didn't get to see, like the stuff that we're not seeing on the internet is a lot of the motion work, the in limine motions, the rulings about the confessions. I couldn't find anything about the hearing because I was thinking, well, maybe it was televised.
Isn't that supposed to be like public domain for the public to be able to get their hands on if they want to look at it?
There should be. Certain things are public. So if you file a motion, like the motion to suppress that you found, yeah, that's part of the public record in the sense like it's part of his file that you can access because it got filed with the court.
Okay.
Now, a lot of those hearings, unless they were done under seal, you could walk in as a member of the public and sit there and listen. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times there's no recording. So it seems like this had a lot of media attention. So the media came, and that's why we have those recordings at trial. But there's no camera in the courtroom recording all proceedings, for better or worse, right? I'd probably like it, but no.
I don't know. This guy, Court TV had like, it seemed like they had the entire trial.
Yeah, and that's because Court TV got involved. They probably filed a media request. The judge granted the media request, and then they were able to record what they could. And even if they recorded, you know, the majority of the trial, mm-hmm, it doesn't seem, I didn't see anything on the jury selection, and I didn't see the in limine motions, and I didn't see any of the motions that happened from arraignment till the time you get to trial. Yeah. Now, the litigation about the motion to suppress might have been, you know, weeks, months before you ever get to trial. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to have a whole set of motions that are right before. And I didn't see those online. And that's, I probably would have argued the voluntariness right before trial.
Yeah, I tried to find any type of information about the jurors. All I could get was, you know, how many men, women, and that 11 of them were white.
Yeah.
But no names and nothing like that.
Was that the 12? So it was 11 were white.
And well, they had... They didn't say, because I know three of them were all alternates, but they didn't say if any of the alternates were white. They didn't say if they were all 11 were actual jurors that sat on the mm-hmm trial. It's very, very, I found just very vague information.
But the appellate lawyer doesn't just look at the trial either. They also get to look at everything that happened up until the beginning. So they're going to look at that motion to suppress to find out why it was denied and if the judge did the right thing. You know, usually the things you want to look at if you're doing appellate work are the decisions by the judge that was wrong. The stuff for about the lawyer, 9 times out of 10, the appellate court will look at it and say, whatever, good enough. There was one case out of Texas. It's like a famous case that we all cite why we're going to be fine whenever we get worried that we've done something wrong. But the lawyer was like sleeping through portions of the trial, and the appellate court said, it's cool. He was, you know, the lawyer was awake for the most important parts.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Appellate courts will bend over backwards to uphold convictions, especially when it comes to, you know, they never want to say the defense attorney did a bad job. But it seems like this might be one of those times it actually rises to that level. I mean, this was crazy.
How can you say that our justice system is fair and accurate when shit like that goes on?
If you're not
going to base decisions on actual facts and shit that actually went down, then our justice system is absolutely 100% flawed.
Totally. And I mean, it's like, it's every little piece of it is as good as the pieces that get made up, right? So mm-hmm, if the defense attorney does a bad job, if the judge does a bad job, if the prosecutor's overly aggressive and is hiding evidence, or it, you know, didn't do a thorough job in investigation, if the police are lying, it all just starts to add up, right? And so mm-hmm, in this guy's case, it's like, it's really hard to pinpoint the one thing that leads to the wrongful conviction, because there's so many different things that were wrong.
Yeah.
That almost is a harder situation as an appellate lawyer, because you're looking at it and you're like, I can't just say this one thing happened and as a result, he got convicted, because it's like the police fucked up because they didn't do a thorough investigation, and the defense screwed up because they didn't do their own investigation. They didn't talk to the right people. They didn't get the right experts. The prosecution's case was thin at best, right? Like it was what, 6 witnesses?
Yeah, they didn't prove anything beyond a shadow, reasonable doubt.
Not at all. You know, but you look at that as the appellate lawyer, and I think your strongest argument is the confession, at least as like being narrowly focused. But Who knows?
The cops, everybody, they had tunnel vision. They had complete 100% tunnel vision. Because they didn't really investigate anybody else. They didn't investigate Dalton.
There's no way.
Well, it did seem that the defense brought that out, right? That once they picked up this guy, good enough, they closed that case.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They did at least mention that. And actually, going back to Dalton for just a second, it was towards the end when the prosecutor had him on the scene, was asking him, you know, it was after the defense had brought up the fact that he didn't want to be there. He didn't give a shit about helping bring justice to his murdered fiance, whom he loved, and all this stuff. So prosecution is trying to, you know, make him sound better, I guess. Brown was goading him into saying what he said. And he said on the stand that he didn't want to be there because he wholeheartedly believed that the defendant was guilty. Is he allowed to say that?
No, absolutely not.
The judge said nothing. The defense said nothing.
Right. So that's ineffective assistance of counsel. The defense should have objected. It's called vouching. You can't speak to someone's guilt or innocence. I would have been like jumping on the defense table, demanding a mistrial.
Like, I mean, just specifically for that, that could have possibly got a mistrial, right?
Right. And I love that, like, even as, and not to say that, you know, you're not super smart, but as a non-lawyer, you're like, that feels real bad. Like, that doesn't seem like it should be legal. And no. Then his two lawyers, his whole team's like, that's cool.
I know. They said nothing. They didn't even breathe hard. And you can hear this guy breathing the whole damn time he was there.
Right. You can hear the interpreter interpreting for him.
Yes. I know. Oh my gosh. And no. I don't know if I'm just being nitpicky, but could you hear his voice shaking like the entire time he was talking? Like, he was so fucking nervous. Like, aren't defense attorneys supposed to be like balls to the wall, super confident, in your face, ready to go?
Oh, you meant like, the attorney. I thought you meant Dalton Jack. I'm like, he probably was a little nervous.
Oh, yeah. No, Dalton showed no emotion whatsoever.
I can't say that these would be two attorneys I would hire to represent me. I mean, maybe my worst enemy, but these were not skilled trial attorneys in any respect. Now, you know, in their defense, if you're a private lawyer or, you know, they've got their own private firm, so they may not be doing a ton of trials, but you've got to think they knew that this was a high media case.
Yeah.
And like, this is the level of preparation that they had.
I could have tried this case better and I have no idea how to do it.
Absolutely. You could have. I mean, the two of them, like I said, I would rarely want to get on, you know, a podcast and say openly to the defense community, two other defense attorneys are doing a terrible job, but
sure.
They were doing a terrible job. Like, yeah. I think someone needs to report them. Like, what happened? And then she was like, the way she was talking about him in her opening, it was like she really didn't like him at all. Like, it just came across like, oh,
like, oh. she was one of those racist people right along with the jury and everybody else.
Exactly. Totally. Like, oh, I gotta defend this guy, so here's my opening, you know. And I was just like, and then she talked about, like, you know, I said the thing about how the shoveling the poop. She came back to that like three times. Like, why are you so fixated on this man? Like, it seems like he's got a good legal issue. If they made a good record about the confession, at least they brought the motion to suppress. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that was the best motion to bring. I would have brought that along with like a voluntary, involuntary. No, so I would have definitely wanted to center this on a involuntary, voluntary. And so they might have waived that issue if they didn't file it. But
now, that seems that, like a special... By involuntary, voluntary, you mean coerced confession?
Right.
Okay.
Because you can have Miranda issues, but if a court deems your confession involuntary, it's out for all purposes. And so that's
fruit of the
much
poisonous
strong...
tree.
Fruit of the poisonous tree comes from language from the suppression. That's a Fourth Amendment idea.
Oh, okay.
So you've got they're coming from all different angles, right? So you've got your Fourth Amendment, which is, if I stop you illegally and then your confession flows from the illegal stop, which is what they did, right? They came to his work and that confession. So that's why they were targeting it from the motion to suppress, which is usually your weakest way of targeting statements, because the officers are going to be like, it was consensual. He came with us. which
is true.
Right. So that's why I could see that potentially the judge denied it for that reason. And if they didn't file, another motion to exclude the confession and based it on these other factors, the Miranda issue and the voluntariness issue, then theoretically, the only other way they could go at it for the appeal would be ineffective assistance of counsel. If the motion was denied, then this guy may have a good issue depending on how things went down. But, you know, I think maybe I'm jaded at this point. You don't see many of these coming back. Unfortunately, a lot of times, like, there's just not anything an appellate lawyer can do. And also, you know, who knows about the quality of the Iowa appellate lawyers based on what I see from their defense bar.
Well, okay, so if the appellate people can't do anything, can't he take it to a higher court? Because
he can't. That's usually as far as it goes. There are times when higher courts will consider review, but you're not necessarily guaranteed. And it really also depends on Iowa structure. So like California, you have three levels, trial court, appellate court, Supreme Court.
Right.
And you're not automatically entitled to review. And there's, depending on which issue it is, the voluntariness issue could be something that could be reviewed by like a federal court theoretically, but getting it there is really tough unless like all of a sudden ACLU wants to like take up your case. So it really, at the appeal, you only usually get the one shot.
Wow. So if his appellate attorney does jack shit, I mean, he can still petition like the US Supreme Court to see if they will look at his case, but I mean, he's not even guaranteed that they'll even take a glance at it, right?
Exactly. Right.
Wow.
And so it's just, you're entitled to that one appeal. And then, you know, that there's other things that can happen. There's other motions that can be filed in certain circumstances. If really persuasive new evidence comes to light later on, DNA evidence, that confession from the inmate, it seems weird, right? Like,
yeah,
the whole sex trafficking thing, I don't know, to me just sounds like smoke and mirrors. And that, like,
I think that was just an aside, because I don't think it was done for the sex trafficking thing. It just seems like the inmate was bringing it up to make it more appealing, maybe.
Yeah.
Have somebody take a closer look at it, because, you know, sex trafficking is a huge thing right now.
Is it though? To me, maybe it's just because I'm in California, but it seems like one of these things that the conservatives have made up. Like, where is all this sex trafficking? I'm a defense attorney in San Francisco, and I really don't see much sex trafficking. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but, you know, I don't have a ton of evidence of it.
I'm not a political person. I don't like politics because I think it's ridiculous, but it does seem to be like more of a right-wing type of propaganda that they throw out. But I mean, I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, because I mean, it's been proven that human trafficking does exist, but...
Oh, of course it does. Of course it does, right? It absolutely does. I just thought this narrative that it's like lurking in all the dark corners of every small town in Iowa. Like,
everybody in Hollywood's a sex trafficker, you know.
What trap house in Iowa is hiding white, middle-class women who've been sex trafficked? I have questions. That just seems incredibly unreasonable. It just seems very hard to believe, right?
Yeah, I am right there with you, man.
So that's, I think I have some issues with that. But, you know, I think when you're going for a new trial motion, you, at that point, you're not like pandering to a jury, right? You don't have to seem reasonable.
Right.
I would have wanted to go laser focus on Dalton if this was my case, right? And then bring in a confessions expert and try to get his confession out so you didn't have to deal with that.
Well, that's my next question to you. What can be done about Dalton? Because, I mean, it's not like double jeopardy, because he wasn't one on trial. He wasn't convicted or charged with anything. So... Nothing. Why can we not get the FBI or somebody to go in and investigate this? I mean, really do an investigation of this kid.
It's an interesting question. I don't, like, the conviction, Rivera's conviction doesn't stop anyone else from getting another conviction.
Right.
But let's say the FBI got the most amazing information on the planet. I walk in as the defense attorney for Dalton. I'm like, by the way, here's this conviction for the guy that did it. Like, you know? So you get to introduce all the stuff about Rivera. So I've never seen in my experience, after you've gotten a conviction, anybody being interested in pursuing anyone else other than the defense for the guy who got convicted.
So there's no way that the prosecution can get it suppressed of the conviction of Rivera if Dalton was put on trial.
Mm-mm. Third party culpability. Absolutely. No, you would definitely get to bring that in.
Oh,
I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but you would get to bring that in. Because it's the same thing, right? You want to create reasonable doubt. Like, oh, there was blood found in this guy's trunk. Oh, this guy said he led her to the body. Oh, everyone believed. Oh, Addie's convicted. But, and so I think it doesn't stop the agencies from looking into him. But like, are they motivated to do so? Absolutely not. But the defense still could be, right? Like, you know, the appellate could get an investigator. Appellate lawyers often will have investigators. You see when it's, you know, Barry Scheck, Innocence Project, a lot of times they will go out and look into things like that. But as far as the law enforcement agencies are concerned, it is case closed.
Well, I know the local law enforcement, definitely they're not going to.
Oh, even the higher ups, right? The higher ups are also not going to care that some, you know, non-citizen got, you know, wrongfully convicted. The FBI, they don't care. They're just happy that the non-citizen is now behind bars. Like, they were going to do it anyway, right? I mean, ICE would have. So, I mean, maybe that is very cynical and I'm oversimplifying, but they're not going to waste their resources on something like this because it feels bad to the rest of us, you know?
Even if he's not a citizen, he still has the same rights, you know, that we do.
The FBI wouldn't come and help either one of you or Ben if you'd been wrongfully convicted either. just not really concerned, in my experience, in investigating a single case of homicide. Like, think about how many people get convicted across the country. And how many of them are probably wrongfully convicted. I think at the Innocence Project, last number was in the 400s that they've shown that these people were wrongfully convicted of homicides. So it's happening all the time. And when it becomes so challenging from a legal perspective to undo that for him, and getting Dalton convicted doesn't change Rivera's conviction. Let's say in this hypothetical universe, they went after Dalton, they convicted him, not based on new evidence, just on what they already have, got a conviction. It wouldn't help Rivera. The only way that it helps Rivera is if new evidence comes to light, new DNA, new witness statements. DNA is usually the best way to help overturn a conviction.
How is that possible? I mean, you've got the person who is rightfully convicted of the crime. Shouldn't that logically prove that Rivera
with the blood in the trunk and the confession, they would probably just say they were accomplices. Accomplices at that point, though.
Right. So his guilty conviction doesn't actually shed innocence, right? Presumptively, unless there was new evidence that did show Rivera was innocent. So that's why, let's say a knife turned up covered with Molly's blood and Dalton, when confronted with it, Dalton said, I did it. I set up Rivera and I put that one droplet in his trunk. That could actually end up helping, right? That because that's new evidence of a witness statement and new DNA and the murder weapon. So obviously this is not the universe in which we live, but that could undo it. But the conviction itself, if they just said, okay, we've got enough on this guy. He was out of town. His phone was at the house. We should run this. We should charge him too. Like to Ben's point, like, they'd be like, great, now we got two guys in jail. Good for us.
Given that one of the articles you sent us said that 20% of people exonerated who are convicted from DNA evidence had a confession, why are confessions given the extreme amount of weight that they're given?
I don't know. I think it's the human experience. I even struggle when I was looking at Rivera's being like, I think he's guilty. No, I don't. I think he's guilty, right? Like, we all, if somebody says these things that they did it, it's hard to turn off your brain to think that you could be convinced or led or slow played into it. Cause that's a lot of what these techniques are about, right? The Reed method. It's you want to establish the relationship. You want to get the denials. You want to confront them and accuse them of lying. Then you want to give them an out. We know, and then give them the why, right? We know you did this because it wasn't your fault. You're not a bad guy. So you give them some like minimization, mitigation thing to hang their hook on. And then you just keep beating them down with it. And at some point, you know, like you've got the location matters. You're being confronted in like, you know, did you see the interrogation room?
Did I see the interrogation
room? Yeah, did you watch the interrogation video where it was?
Yeah.
Part of.
So that is very, very, it looks like every video I've ever had where a sergeant takes someone into an interrogation room. He's pushed in the corner.
In the corner.
He's right there in the corner. He's trapped. He's not allowed to go anywhere. They're telling him he's free, but he's not.
And they're getting really close to him.
Mm-hmm. And now they start further away and they move closer in. They up the intensity. So psychologically, what's happening in his head is he's so tired. He can't think straight. He just wants to go home. They're giving him kind of these promises of leniency, which goes to the weight of the involuntariness, right?
Right.
They denied access to his family, goes to the weight of the, you know, the voluntariness. They brought up his daughter. They're using all these coercive factors. So your brain is scrambling inside your own head, like, oh my God, like, you know, if I just say this, maybe if I give them what they want, if I agree to that thing that sounds not as bad, I did it in self-defense or whatever, then, you know, it happens, I think, way more often than we as lay people think it can.
I don't know, because I watch so much true crime and especially like confession tapes that
I'm in the same boat.
I don't believe a confession I'd like, no, he was coerced. Yeah,
that
was
I can cool. overlook the confession for sure. But for
that's amazing. But I think it probably goes to how much research you guys do. But even knowing what I know, I still struggle, right? Like,
but you watch all this stuff too. You should be in the same boat.
I am from an intellectual perspective, but if you put me on a jury and I heard confession evidence, I think it's just going to be hard, right? I think that human experience is like, he said he did it. He did it.
The hard thing for me is leading them to the body, and I never even considered what you've kind of insinuated, that there's a possibility that he didn't lead the police to the body, the police led him to the body. And it's like that actually could have happened, because there's nowhere that I've seen, not that it doesn't exist, but there's nowhere I've seen where it says, I know where the body is, this is the location, I'll take you there.
His words were that when he got there, it was like, you know, they kept asking him about it, he's like, well, I brought you here, didn't I, so I must have done it.
Right.
Which sounds a lot like, I don't know how we got here, but I guess I did it.
Yeah.
Right. Which seems to me like that it's very possible that they convinced him, you know, that he had led them there when that wasn't true at all. But
he
would need to see
a diminished mental capacity. Like you said, that's very possible.
Yeah.
Even if like a reasonable person, if I've been up for 23 hours and I might, you know, depending on what happened in the comments before and how they slow played him into saying he was going there, you know, like they could probably trick me. I don't know. But I think they didn't have body worn camera. They had recording when they were in the interrogation room. So even, you know, though we may not have access to everything, it does seem like if they got in the car and went somewhere, there's no body worn camera recordings of the officers. That seems highly suspect.
It seems highly suspect. And if he's falling asleep in the interrogation room, the place that I fall asleep the most is if I'm a passenger in a car.
Yeah.
Like, he might have woken up and they're like, yeah, you led us here.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I think that's so true.
This is 2021 when the case and everything, well, it's 2018 when this happened. But I mean, if I remember correctly, cops were having, that's when they had to have their body cams, right? It was back then, right? Or is that more recent?
Well, everything's different, right? Like whether or not they have to have body cams is that's not true. So like it's state specific, right? I don't think there's any federal rule that requires it. I think most police departments do. For instance, like our San Francisco Police Department, San Francisco's easy, right? Because we just have one police department instead of, say, like Contra Costa County or other counties where it might be different cities that have, like, each has their own police department. But usually each internal police department will have their own rules about their body camera. And they're coming from their kind of contract within the police union. So like, you know, they're supposed to have their body worn camera activated at these times. And there's rules about when they should turn it off and when it's okay to turn it on. I mean, turn it when they're supposed to turn on, when they're supposed to turn it off. But, you know, I don't know back in at that time, 2017, 2018, what Iowa's rules were. I suspect that there was no hard, fast requirement that they have it.
Well, they sure did. And that's for sure. Cause there's absolutely no physical proof of what the hell happened when they took him out there.
Now, are you sure of that? Because then, you know, I would be fighting like hell if I'm the defense attorney to throw out all of the stuff in the middle that wasn't recorded. There was no audio recording. At least I'd be cross-examining the cops like crazy on that on the stand.
I've never found anything.
I didn't watch the cross-examination of Romero. But, you know, if I was a defense attorney, I'd be like, why didn't you bring a recording? Did you not have audio? Do you not have body-worn camera? Was that not an option? How were you writing down verbatim what he said? How do you remember? Did you write notes? Where are those notes? Right? Like how does she remember so clearly that they led them to the body? Right? Like what were the words that he said? What was the first thing he said to you? How did, when you left the police station, what was the first instruction he gave to you? Get on the highway, right? I would want to walk her through each and every statement to just so that this guy who like said zero words up until that point, other than ahas, is now going to be like, oh yeah, get on the 405. I'm going to need you to make a left-hand turn and go 2 miles, get off at this exit. Like, no, that's crazy. So
right. And we already know she lied on stand, right, about him sleeping. So it's, they should have been grilling her.
Yeah.
Well, it's just another instance where they, like you said, were just lazy and dropped the ball on their cross-examinations.
Right. And I mean, it's also, I would say it's more than just lazy. They're probably not skilled enough to know how to do that. You know, like you can say, well, oh, you just made it up that he took you to the location. No, I didn't. Or you can do it in a way that you go piece by piece. Like, well, then tell me what he said next then, if he told you. Which direction was the very next direction? Okay, so if you can't remember, how do you remember exactly what he said? You're telling me, so then you would want to point out that they are just internally inconsistent. So it seems like these lawyers also lacked not only, you know, any work ethic, but also skills too. It just, woof.
Kind of seems like it was their first trials.
I'm telling you, I've seen law students do a better opening and closing. Oh, go back and watch the defense guys, just the first 3 minutes. It's the most hilariously bad closing I've ever seen. Doesn't say his client's name for 7 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jose Baez also thanked the jury, but it was like 15 seconds and then he was on to his closing.
Sure. It's very common. You know, the prosecution will usually start off by being, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. A lot of times they teach you to do that in law school. I don't, right? I think it is a waste of time. I usually hit really hard. This last time, my theme, I walk up and my first thing is like, words are violence or whatever my theme is. And you start right away and you tell your client side of it. And like, you get really into, you start off hitting hard with your client's theory of the case. Mm-hmm. They meandered through the weeds of the thank yous and then the, we love Molly, she's so great, she would have gone on to do great things in her life. Like, you do that at some point in your closing, because of course Molly didn't deserve any of this, right? She's not, she didn't deserve to die.
So why would you want to bring that up in your closing and give, that just makes them feel more sympathetic towards Molly and want to convict him more.
Sure, it totally. And the way he did it totally set them up to be way more sympathetic with Molly and remind them of Molly. I'm going to be trying to remind them that this, we don't compound the tragedy with another conviction. You don't bring Molly back. We don't solve this by putting an innocent man in jail.
Right.
So early they had the one sentence that said, you know, Molly deserved justice, but so does Christian Rivera, right? They should have stuck with that theme for sure.
Well, and I would have tweaked it. You don't convict Mr. Rivera just to get Molly justice. You don't convict an innocent man to get Molly justice. That is an injustice.
Yeah, that's better.
But it was that was just their one line though. But you do want to put it in there to remind them that this conviction, which, and that's the big challenge you have with juries in homicides, which is they want a conviction so bad. Right. Like the worse the kind of injury or assault to the victim or the harm, the more people are going to start lowering that reasonable doubt burden. Because like they just really want to convict somebody when someone was so badly hurt or died. And so
not for Casey Anthony. Anyway.
No, you know, I mean, no.
I'm still mad about that. Just
but no, I, you know, 9 times out of 10, maybe 99 times out of 100, it's the opposite, you know, like when say it's a petty theft, you know, someone stole a candy bar and you think they're real guilty, but like, whatever, you're just going to say not guilty because you don't care. Right. Like it just, no one cares when it's low harm. So you're fighting an uphill battle already with dealing that elephant in the room that they're so sympathetic to the loss of Molly. And I mean, you really can't have kind of picked a worse kind of victim as a defense attorney, right? She's cute, she's sweet, she seems lovable. You know, the prosecution probably plastered the entire trial with images of her, she's got her family. Yeah. So you do wanna kind of take the air out of their sails by doing that. But the way that defense attorney did was exactly wrong.
It didn't help their case at all from what I could tell.
I mean, it seems unclear what their case was. Mr. Hannah Rivera.
To kind of sum this up, from a person who does not have a career in law, what can normal people do to help someone they feel is wrongfully convicted?
Well, I mean, you might want to start a petition, right, that the appellate court should take this seriously, could get signatures. You see, you know, like starting a GoFundMe for the appellate lawyer. I don't know if they could take outside information. I'm trying to think, what have I seen people do in the past? I've got one client who's done a lot of kind of his own work on these things, but getting a lot of public interest, starting a blog, right? Starting something, or, you know, like a website, like Justice for So-and-So, getting the name out there, creating political pressure somehow. Because if you could make it bigger than just this guy was wrongfully convicted, but if it's a bigger political issue, then they might take note, right? Then, you know, it's all kind of interconnected, the justice system and politics and who's paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, because once they start thinking about, like, if a lot of eyes are on this case, it does help, I think. And it's, especially in the position he's in, most of these cases where we come to them, like the guy in Serial or Making a Murder, my guess would be that they're all past the appellate process. And now you're really in the like landscape of, well, there's not a lot we can do. But, you know, right now might be the moment to strike and try to get a lot of public support for an appeal. Right? Because if the appellate court was to feel like reversing the conviction wouldn't be met with, like, you know, lynchings or people with pitchforks, because that's what goes on in judges' mind, like, oh, am I really going to turn this case back a homicide? They don't want to do it. But if they feel like there's a lot of public support and that they're not going to, you know, be recalled, then they might be more willing to do it. So,
well, I doubt there would be public support in the area that it took place in, but I mean, from more like a national standpoint, I mean, you could probably, and again, I hate to bring up Democrats versus Republicans, but you could really get, I think, a strong Democratic support, you know, just based on the fact that he is an illegal immigrant and he's being thrown under the bus because of that fact. I mean, you could play it that way.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, that could also be like looking into resources for non-citizens, trying to get somebody. The other thing too, is that he, without the appeal being filed, getting him a really good appellate lawyer, right? Instead of just somebody who may be taking it on and not care.
Who's so that getting chick that's famous that does like all these wrongfully convicted cases? She's on one of those Netflix series. God, what the hell's her name? I want to email her.
But that's the thing, you know, there's probably resources like for non-citizens, maybe they have, you know, but even just getting it away from the person who may not care, like, and I don't want to like throw down the appellate lawyers in Iowa, but they may not care, they may not look at it with the same intensity that if we, you know, messaged like a La Raza type group or something like that. But you know, that he's in a unique position where all is not lost. And that's a better position than, say, the guy in Serial or Making of a Murder post-appeal, right?
Right.
So right. He's still got one big chance kind of in front of him, and getting the funding, getting the help, getting the support, getting this, you know, kind of public support, the eyes on the case, even if it's outside. And Iowa doesn't, it might be a red state, but there are pockets of people who would care about this, you know, Des Moines.
Sure, yeah. So maybe not that town, but maybe like the, like places like Des Moines or the bigger cities, I would imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. And so just kind of redirecting people to look at this in a new light, I think. So if a judge felt pressured even from other areas in the state, I think that would be really helpful. So I think those would be the two things, public support and, you know, getting it to the right appellate lawyer.
Okay, Ben, we got our work cut out for us.
We're going to save
them. The Abyss is starting a campaign of free Christian.
I wonder, you know, and the thing is, I'm racking my brain. I'm like, do I know anyone that would take this on pro bono who does work? Because you'd need somebody who's licensed to practice in Iowa.
Right.
Like, I don't know anyone. Because it's a state level issue, right? This isn't like a federal case. So my bar card, I can practice in California and federal.
You can practice in federal?
Yeah. Yeah, so I could go and do a federal homicide in Iowa, but I couldn't pick up a state charged homicide because I'm not barred in Iowa.
Well, the fact that DCI and the FBI were called in, doesn't that make it a federal?
No, it just means like the feds were involved in the investigation. Like I've had cases where like they might have done the wiretap or cell phone records and they've been like, this is small potatoes, you have it, state court or whatever. Because they're two separate tracks, right? And it just depends. Like there's the federal courthouse, you know, three blocks away from where I work. All right. Well, thank you guys. This was a fun one to look at. I'm sorry I hadn't heard about it before. But
as always, you are welcome to come back on and talk about any case you want to, because it's always such a pleasure to have you on. You're so very, very knowledgeable at what you do.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get you for
absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Have a great night, hon.
You too. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. All right, guys. This was probably one of my favorite interviews so far. Martina is
always
amazing. She's a powerhouse, man. She's awesome. Yeah. I want her on every trial case if we do. She's just freaking fantastic. Sorry it ran a little bit long, but you know what? I'm a talker. She's willing to answer, so just enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, if you want to get in touch with us, our email is throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. We are also on Snapchat, Twitter, and Instagram at abysspodcast1.
Peace out, guys.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss Podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff!